resources. Thank you. So good morning, everybody. Welcome back. Hope everyone had a wonderful Yom Tov. Everybody should be in good health. I hope we like this. It feels more than people crushed in the side, which is good. You prefer it in there, then all of a sudden someone's sitting on the floor and it's no good. So, exactly. So, the topic that we're going to discuss this morning is relevant to the article that I sent out last week to some of you. This very interesting phenomenon in Israel, which drew a lot of media attention, even though it itself didn't. Yes, so the topic that we're talking about is this movement of Olim LeBerlin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot.
People talking about this, this one particular guy who decided he's going to have a campaign to try to convince Israelis to leave Israel and move to Berlin.
Mm-hmm. With the intention of getting the Israeli government to pay attention to the economic hardships that many of them are facing.
Exactly. So this, what Paul's alluding to is that in 2011, there were major protests in the streets of Tel Aviv about what people, what's that? About cottage cheese, the price of food, economic inequality, etc. So there was discussion back then, and now all of a sudden the guy decided he's going to have a movement. They're going to go to Berlin. There was an ad that was on Facebook about how cheap... What is it? Putting Lebanon, how cheap Lebanon is in Berlin. So it's fine. And they decided they were going to have a big rally last week in Tel Aviv, and there were going to be lots of people there. In the end, there were like 40, 50 people. Nobody showed up. There was no stand. There was no Air Berlin. There was nothing. It was Gornish mid-Gornish. But it did raise, there's plenty of, at least you have a seat at the table. We set it up properly for everybody. So... But we have no sheets because my printer is acting funny.
At the screen.
Yes, you can. So it drew a whole media maelstrom, almost a firestorm of criticism back and forth. But it got me thinking when I saw this, I was like, oh, this is a good topic for discussion because it touches on several different issues that are actually, some of them are actually quite timely. So the first and foremost is the idea that someone should create a movement to leave Israel is, at first glance, is extremely problematic, right? We, many of us in this room, are not just Torah Jews, but we believe that in our day, with the ability to build and settle in the land of Israel in the amazing, wondrous time that we are, so there is perhaps a unique opportunity, and maybe even a mitzvah, to encourage people to move to Israel, to build the state of Israel, to buy Israel bonds, whatever we can do. You know, to many of us in this room, our Masorah, our tradition, belongs to that of what we call the Mizrahi community, or the Bnei Akiva community, or the Torah Eretz Yisrael community. So it's almost unthinkable to us that somebody should be propagating the idea of a movement to leave Eretz Israel, whereas we're busy trying to encourage people to move to Israel. So just the whole concept is flawed, and from a halachic standpoint, I think there are a couple of things that we should think about. The first is obviously the most basic, which is the mitzvah of living in Israel. So forgetting for right now the price of putting in Berlin, but there is a mitzvah, according to most authorities, there is a mitzvah to live in Israel. Now there are excuses for those of pathetic Jews like me who are living in Golos. So there are excuses that we have. We live here because of this reason, we live here because of that reason. But there is a mitzvah to, according to most authorities, to live in Israel. Now, you're right, there's a big debate about what are the exact parameters of that mitzvah. Ramban, very well known, the Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, so he himself, actually, when he was after, in 1263, the Ramban went to Barcelona. He lived in northern Spain, in Girona, but he was in Barcelona disputing a famous apostate named Pablo Cristiani in Barcelona in front of King James of Aragon. And then afterwards, he published his account, what's called Vikuach HaRamban. We have this. And the Ramban, because of that published account, was sentenced to death. And then a group of Jews who were influential were able to have his sentence commuted. So near the age of 70, he was exiled from the kingdom of Aragon. So he had to flee. He left with no family. He traveled to Israel by himself. And we have several letters that he have that he wrote to his son. His son's name was Nachman, after his father. And the Ramban was a tremendous Ohiv Eretz Yisrael. And irrespective of that, the Ramban also had an opinion, a halachic opinion, that was not influenced by his, you know, his love for Israel. It was influenced by his understanding of the Psukim, that there is an actual proactive mitzvah, one of the 613 that says is a mitzvah to settle the land of Israel, to live in Israel, period. A biblical mitzvah. Now, the reason why he brings that up is because it's in the section at the end of the Rambam where the Rambam enumerates his 613 mitzvahs in his introduction to the multi-volume work where the Rambam explains them, and the Rambam leaves it out. He does not mention a mitzvah to live in Israel. The Ramban says, excuse me, I think the Rambam, he omitted it, he forgot it. In the language of the Ramban, he forgot it. The Rambam did not forget it. The Rambam did not think that it should be counted as a separate one of the 613, and there are a whole host of reasons for that. On the other hand, there are rabbinic authorities like Rav Moshe Feinstein who assume that it's a mitzvah harishus. It's a proper thing to do. It's a mitzvah to do so, but it's not an obligation. So that might explain why so many of us are living here, that it's not necessarily a definitive obligation. It's a proper thing to do, and there's a lot of discussion in the middle. But the idea that we're going to create a movement to leave Israel, right off the bat, is problematic from the standpoint of the mitzvah of living in Israel. But, in actuality, there is a more pointed problem with this Olim LeBerlin movement. And that is a Rambam that appears in Hilchos Malachim, in chapter 5, Perakei Halacha Tes, where the Rambam says the following, Aser Lotzeis Me Eretz Yisrael L'chutzala Aretz La'olam. It is prohibited to leave Eretz Yisrael to outside of Eretz Yisrael forever. It's prohibited to leave. Ella accepting Lilmod Torah, to study Torah, Lisa Isha, to find a wife, O Lahatzil Miyad Goyim, or to fight some kind of battle to save someone who had been taken captive. And again, remember, in these times, captivity and ransom was commonplace for a different discussion. V'yachzar la'oretz, the Rambam says, and you return to the land. So there's an actual iser to leave Eretz Yisrael. V'chein yotzehu l'schora, a person can leave for business. If they have business interests outside of Israel, they can leave for business and then they come back. Avol lishkon b'chutz la'oretz asur, but to settle in chutz la'oretz is prohibited. El imkein, except im chazak sham hara'av, if there's a famine in Israel, and the Rambam tells you, how bad does it have to be? Because everything is relative. Right? This is an important ha'ara in general. I think we once spoke about this a couple of years ago. Rabbi Ehrenfeld mentioned it yesterday in his drasha from the book by Daniel Pink, To Sell Is Human. It tells an unbelievable story about in Madison Avenue, an executive who was walking in Central Park, and he sees a man sitting on the street corner, and he's holding a little cup, and he has a sign that says, I am blind. Some of you remember, I think I told this story once. So he sees that the guy is not making any money, so he goes over to the blind man. I think his name was Rosser. He goes over to the blind man, and he says, excuse me, sir, I can tell you, I work on Madison Avenue, I'm in advertising. I bet that with four words, I can change your luck. He says, what does he have to lose? Nothing. He's sitting there with a cup that's half empty. So he goes, gets a pen, writes on the side four words, and then he just stands on the side with an acquaintance of his from the office, and he says, look what happens. And all of a sudden, within a half hour, people are dropping money, they're dropping dollar bills, and the blind man is ecstatic. So he says, the advertising executive comes up, he says, can you tell me what did you write there? He says, I wrote four words. I wrote, it is springtime, and I am blind. Because it's about perception. It's about relative. Am I poor? Well, relative to whom? Is it, you know, is it a man sitting on the street corner who's blind, who could use money? Or is it springtime and everybody else is enjoying the beautiful weather and this guy can't do that? So all of a sudden, the whole yesod of this book, To Sell Is Human, has to do with selling things, everything being relative to something else. Is something good looking? Well, it depends compared to what. Am I happy? Well, compared to what? You know, everything is compared to what? That's the yesod of the book. So what the Rambam is trying to tell you is, well, wait a second. Compared to what? At what point do you say, look, the economy is so bad at Israel, I can't take it. And it's a good question. So the Rambam actually gives you a formula. He says, She nase shove dinar chitin b'shnei dinarin. Wheat that's worth 1 dinar now is worth 2 dinarin. So the economy is depressed half. Now, there are many people who know a lot about finance in this room, much more than I do, so I'm sure there's a way to calculate this, you know, how what this would mean in a modern time. But at that point, the Rambam says, then you can leave. However, the Rambam says, then it depends if it's, you know, there's commerce, maybe you can make a living, even if the price of goods is high. If there's a price of goods is low, the Rambam gets the whole thing. However, he says, Va'afal pisha mutar lotzeis, even though it's permitted to leave, eina midas chasidus, it's not a measure of piety. Shaharei machlon v'kilyon. This is in the Rambam. This is not, Rashi quotes it on the story in Megillas Rus from Shavuos. Rashi quotes it, but it's in the Rambam. The Rambam says, machlon and kilyon. Who are machlon and kilyon? Right, the two sons of Elimelech, whose wives were Orpah and Rus, they left. Shnei gedolei hador hayu, they were great sages. Mipnei tzara gedolei yatsu, they left. V'nischayvu kloya lamakom. The Rambam says they died. They were punished by God because they left Israel.
And they married chicks.
So apparently, that's amazing. The Rambam does not say they were punished because they married non-Jew Moabite women. The Rambam does not say that. They were punished, according to the Rambam, because they left Israel. Now notice, the Rambam does not say that every person is held to that standard, but these were Gedolei Hador. These were leaders. Their influence is going to be felt in the broader community. So they had to hold themselves to a higher standard. It's a Peldik Ezach. That's what I mentioned. I didn't even think about that. The fact that they married Rus and Arpa, let's assume they were Mizgayer, but if they were Gedolei Hador, but that's not what the Rambam says. The Rambam says because they left Israel. So there's a Gemara in Brachos that really brings this home. And again, to me, it's like a big Musar Haskel. When I look in the mirror and I think about this Gemara, the Gemara says that there are certain things that are niknen b'yisurin, that they are acquired through hardship. And one of them is Eretz Yisrael. So there's the famous Natan Alterman poem, Al Magash HaKesef, on a silver platter, that personifies the state of Israel based on the sacrifices of the soldiers. And many people in this room either have family members or know of people. I know my grandfather, Olav Shalom, when he was almost 20 years old, he was a Chassidish boy who had come from Varna, from Galicia, but they were Mizrahi, and he forged his parents' signature and traveled with a group of friends to, at that time, was Palestine in 1934, and he had a T-shirt, undershirt, and shorts, and a shovel. That was, and I don't even know what they ate. You know, Rabbi Pelkovitz, she'll live me well, Muhammad's grandmother is married to Rabbi Pelkovitz, so he told us that his family, his father sent his mother and their family to Israel for a year, I guess it was some kind of sabbatical. He stayed, they lived in Bridgeport, she lived in Yerushalayim. He said, I forget exactly how many dollars he sent them to live for a month in Yerushalayim and what kind of food they had in the 30s. It's nicknamed Yisurin. If we think that it's going to be the lap of luxury with ease, so the Gemara says that's not the case. People pay a tremendous price. We look at the summer, all the families whose tables are now empty every single Friday night, lo aleinu. That's a big price to pay. It's a very, very steep price to pay. But the Rambam says that that's the midas chasidus, that what we aspire to. A chassid is somebody who looks to do more. We want to believe in the dream of the land of Israel. So that's why it's a shame to talk about it from someone who lives in Skokie. Yeah, but big talker. But there are people out there. And that's why this whole idea of Olim le Berlin, to me, it just strikes me as so absurd almost. Now, of course, there is a need for bikoret, there is a need for proper criticism, but it doesn't necessarily mean, maybe it's just a political stunt, but there are people who are living in this world of saying, really, people should leave. And you ask yourself, what does that mean? Obviously, it's going to be difficult. Now, we have to present challenges. So this idea of the Isra of going to Chutz La'aretz is a very interesting one. So then it becomes a shaila, well, wait a second. How about traveling to Eilat? Say my grandmother lives in Yerushalayim, she should live me well. And she occasionally goes with her friends, they go to this place, they go to that place. So what about going to Eilat? Because there's a very big question about whether or not Eilat is geographically part of the land of Israel. It's a big question. What about in the old days, people would go to Sharm el Sheikh, they would go vacations all the time, right? So there is a whole article about this, which unfortunately, again, no one has in front of them, but I'll tell you about it, believe me. In this, in the 20th volume of Truman, Rav Shlomo Tichovsky has a whole article about this question, about leaving Eretz Yisrael, Tzigizund, for different purposes. And one of the things he discusses is about a nofesh, vacation, teyulim. So part of that is going to fit into how a person understands the role of vacation in life. And we understand, and he mentions, that we know there's something called brios haguf. A person has to be physically well, but they also have brios hanefesh. We spoke about this once from the Rambam, that the Rambam says a person has to have, you know, a healthy, balanced life. They have to live in an environment where they feel that they have, you know, headspace. So too here, assuming that going out for a vacation is, he mentions here, that's also for brios hanefesh. A person needs to get some air. So too here, in this case, one could suggest that it's going to be permitted. So he has actually a discussion here, a tshuva from Rav Shmuel Volzner, about the fact that it's prohibited to leave Eretz Yisrael for no reason. But if you have a good reason, if you have some reason why you're going to leave, so he suggests that if it's a tiyul for to see the wonders of nature, of Hashem, then there's reason to be lenient, as long as assuming you're going to come back. Now he points out here in the end that this is an interesting iser in the sense that it applies specifically for the people who live in Israel. Right? For us, there's no iser to go to the Wisconsin Dells because we're already in Chutz Laretz. It's a concern for the people who are living there. We have to deal with the first question, which was, do we have a mitzvah to live there? If we have a mitzvah to live there, what are we doing here? So obviously we have some reason why we're not living in Eretz Yisrael, which has to be a halachically valid reason. But assuming that we have that, so then, you know, we don't have this iser. But this applies to people who are living in Israel, and they, assumably, and that's what he discusses here, there are many reasons why people leave. Another chapter is Yitziyah Mishum Kibud Horim. You know, somebody, they go on Aliyah, but their parents live in Chutz La'aretz. So, what are you going to say? That they can't leave Eretz Yisrael because the Rambam says it's also Lotzeis L'Chutz La'aretz and they have elderly parents, they have to go visit them? That's why he points out that there is a discussion in the Gemara about one of the Amoraim who went to go to Chutz La'aretz to meet his family members, etc. So in this case, certainly, if it's mutter to go because you want to get some relaxation, that's for your Brios HaNefesh, the mitzvah of Kibud Avim. That's, going to the Gemara, that's a very important mitzvah. It's a very difficult mitzvah. So then that would also be permitted. But it's interesting to talk about. There is something that's even more, I would say, amazing about this story, which you see on the screen. Here you have. This is the Shailos HaTshuvos Kol Mevaser. The Kol Mevaser was Rav Meshulam Roth, who was a European-born Rav who died, it must be in the 70s. He lived in Israel, and it was a very big post. And one of the interesting tshuvas that he has in the community where he lived, let's just say, not too many poskim were of the opinion about saying halal on Yom HaTzma'ut. He has a tshuva about saying halal on Yom HaTzma'ut and Yom Yerushalayim. He comes out in the affirmative with a bracha, at least for Yom Yerushalayim. After 67, he has a tshuva about this in his collection of tshuvas called Kol Mevaser. So in that discussion around Yom HaTzma'ut time, everybody talks about, who are involved in this rabbinic discussion, they all talk about Rav Meshulam Roth. I think that's, at least that's how it became known to me. But he has a very, very interesting tshuva here. It's almost shocking, because remember, he's living just after the war in the 60s. So a group of rabbis came to him. This is in Simon Yud Gimel. I downloaded it because I don't have the original. So a bunch of rabbis came to him. Here it is. Simon Yud Gimel. Al Dvar Shehutza Bevi'idas Rabbanim Lahachriz Cherem Mitam Rabbanei Haaretz Shelefiv Osir Yeh Lechol Yehudi Lidroch Al Admas Germania. The question came to Rav Meshulam Roth that a group of rabbis wanted to proclaim an iser, a ban on... What was the ban? Travel to Germany. Notice this doesn't say settling in Germany. He says travel.
He says, "V'kama rabbonim hitzkimu l'tatza'ah."
Some rabbis agreed to this, that they should actually pronounce a ban on stepping foot in Germany.
And he says,
interestingly, that technically, from a halachic standpoint, it is not acceptable. This is why the ban is not acceptable for two reasons. One is, he says, and this, the first half of it, which is not quoted by a later tshuva that I saw from Rav Avadya Yosef, the first half of it he discusses is whether or not rabbis today have the authority to create a ban that is universal. You know, a community can accept upon themselves something. Let's say all the members of the Skokie community, we could decide that some miracle happened to us, so we could decide we're going to have a yontif. We could decide we're going to have a fast day. And that's going to be binding on the community of Skokie and all the children who live here and anybody from future generations. We could decide that as a community. But we can't decide what's going to happen in Pittsburgh. You know, we could decide what happens in Skokie. That's as a kehillah. So the question was, can we decide something happens? What if we got all the rabbis together? So his first argument is, no, Bizman Azeh, after the time of the Talmud, there's nobody who could say there's a binding chayrim that exists on the entire world. The question then becomes an interesting question about the chayrim of Rabbeinu Gershom, which was, I would say, probably the most well-known and widespread chayrim about polygamy. Also, he has many, many charamim, not opening people's mail, things like that. Okay, but his second argument is that it's a gzeira she'ein rov hatzibur yecholim lamud ba. It is a decree that most of the people in the community cannot undertake. And therefore, it is not binding. By the way, it could be not binding in one of two ways. There's a discussion in Poskim. Is it not binding because the rabbis don't have the right to make such a decree? Or even if they make such a decree, it's actually null and void. Because this has to do with part of the balance of authority in a community between the rabbis and the balabatim. Rabbis, God bless rabbis. We love rabbis. They're very good. They're very important. They do a lot of good things. But the rabbis have to be in touch with what are the needs of the community. They can't go around making rabbinic enactments where the people are not prepared to accept them. So this is the counterbalance, that if there is a gzeira, a decree that most people cannot handle, then the decree is invalid. So says Rav Meshulam Roth, Zichrono Livracha, he says, look, people travel all the time now. And it's amazing because he was living in the 60s and 70s. I would say he probably never even dreamed what it would be like today. People come and go from Israel all the time. They travel halfway across the world every week. So he says it's very impractical. It's improper to say that, oh, everybody's going to say you can never land in Germany. I was in Germany for a few minutes once. My parents sent me. I was very privileged. My parents sent me to study French Jewish history for a couple of weeks in Paris. So I happened to take, I decided we were in Strasbourg. So I figured I should take a bus and see the Rhine River. So that was a big mistake. I didn't need to spend 5 minutes in Germany. And because I did that, I missed my train to go to Colmar. It was bad news. It was hashgacha. But people travel all the time. They change in Frankfurt. They change in Munich. They go there for business. You can't say that you can't go there. But what's interesting also in the tshuva is in the beginning, when he starts, he says, I don't expect to follow this, but just so you should know, I'm not making it up. Omnam. He says, Omnam, however, mitzad hashkafa hapolitit. However, from an outlook, what a person's perspective should be, hahegyonit vahamusarit, sodeket ma'od hatza'azu. He says, from a moral and ethical standpoint, he thinks it is a proper concept. In concept. He says, ve'ein shum safek, it's no doubt to him, shala'acha maise ha'zavos v'ha'ashmodos, after the terrible destruction of the Jewish communities, sha'olulu lanu ha'germanim be'achzorius no'ra'ah, that the Germans did to us with awesome cruelty. Right? Some of you are familiar with Browning's book from the 1970s called Ordinary Men, about how it was essentially ordinary Germans who were participating in these police battalions and SS battalions. And then later, Daniel Goldenhagen from Harvard, famous, huge, huge book published a couple years ago called Hitler's Willing Executioners. So it's average, ordinary people who perpetrated these crimes. He says, Shaluhoisa kumosa mimosa olam. In the history of the Jewish people, there never was such a crime. Gam below hachrazas harabanim kol yehudi yimna atzmo. A person should refrain themselves. Again, this is not. I'm not saying this is halacha lemaisa. People ask their own shalos whether they want to go on to limb, where they want to travel, what they want to do. But this is his opinion. His opinion is that a person should refrain. Vihe libo nokfo milahal milahal mi lehatzig kaf raglo al admasam hatmea. To step foot in that place. And I have heard that there are people, especially survivors, some who want to go back to their place where they were, and many of them said they would never step foot in Germany. And many people have different iterations about this. Some people, you know, when they go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington and they see a certain German car factory with slave labor. I remember this when I went. They had pictures of Jews working in striped uniforms in this particular car manufacturer plant in Germany. So some people don't buy those automobiles. The idea is, he's saying that from an ethical and moral standpoint, it should give us pause. Now, you're right. There are many counterbalancing factors. There are many things to think about. These aren't the same people. They're their grandchildren. How long do you hold it over them, etc.? A lot of different things. But this Jew was probably written in the 50s or 60s. It's not dated, so you don't know exactly when it was written. But at that time, certainly, even in Israel, there was a huge debate about reparations, right? The fact that all the buses were Mercedes-Benz and the cab drivers are Mercedes-Benz, that was a very, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Menachem Begin was very opposed to the idea, the concept of reparations. So this is the other thing that I think some people found was so alarming to them, was you want to tell me we're going to go on Yerida, we're going to go to Venice. Venice, such famous Jewish city from the Middle Ages, right? We're going to go to Lucerne, we're going to go to some Italian community. Well, the Italian Jewish communities are age old. Some even from the, some people suggest from the Churban HaBayis, there were Jews in Rome. So, oh, we're going to go there. Some, you know, but to say we're going to go to Berlin. So there's almost like a visceral reaction from some people. How could you talk about going to Berlin? However, and this is where I think we can look at it from a different vantage point, which is that, and someone once told me this is a beautiful idea from Rav Kook, and I think it's very true, is that whenever you find a phenomenon in life, it's like an idea in Chassidus, that every falsehood, every sheker, has to have some grain of truth to it. It has to have some element of emes. Otherwise, it wouldn't exist in the world. So our job is always to find what is the musr, what is the grain of truth within the sheker, within the husk. So in this movement also, there is something about this story that should resonate with us and should make us think. And that comes back to the economic question. Now, again, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to agree with every argument that every blogger or every protest person, but the concept of social welfare is something we should think about. Social welfare in the original meaning of the term, which is the welfare of the citizens of a society. That's something that we should be thinking about. And actually, if there's any time to think about it, this is the time to think about it. Why? Because this year is Shemitah. And this is the time to start thinking about what that means on a practical level for people in the 2014. So where is it? It's here. No, it's here. I'll show you also. There was a Kenes Shemitah. See the cover here from here. The Kibbutz Adati. This is from Sivan Tovshin Ayindal, just a few months ago. It's called Amudim, and it's a 60-page collection of essays. It's entitled Karva Shinas Hasheva. The seventh year is approaching. So it was a Kenes Shemitah al Hahityashvut Ha'uvedet. And here is it. Here it is. It was July 17th, 2014. It took place in Kibbutz Gan Shmuel. I have no idea where that is. And they had a whole bunch of presenters, and they have about 20 articles. I went through some of them, all about what does Shemitah mean today in Israel. Now, part of it has to do with the halachic concept of Shemitah, but part of it has to do with the Tame HaMitzvah, the reason for the mitzvah. What does that mean for us? See, we know, we Paskin, we have a rule that you don't Alo darshinon taima dekra. You do not learn the reasons for mitzvahs. Now, what does it mean you don't learn the reasons for mitzvahs? So the Gemara says like this. You have to understand there's a difference between studying the reason for the mitzvah and using the mitzvah, its reason, to regulate the application of the mitzvah. Okay? So I'll give you an example. Lo sach bo begin almana. The din is that you're not allowed, if there's a woman who is an almana, you're not allowed to take her clothing as collateral if you are a creditor. So the Gemara says, Reb Shimon says, I'll tell you why. Because especially in the old days, if a woman didn't have a means of support, so she was probably impoverished. So why is she going to be prepared to give you her nightgown for collateral? That's all she has. If she had something else, she would give it to you. So here she is. You have a poor woman who's living alone, and the guy is going to come to her house. Now, the din is, it's true in Bechlal, if a person gives you collateral, they give you the pajamas. So in the morning, you take the pajamas. In the evening, you bring it back. You can't take their pajamas, even as collateral. So they have to have their pajamas. In the morning, they'll give you their pajamas. And at night, they'll give you their suit. And they're going to keep exchanging it back and forth. So Reb Shimon says, you know why you can't take collateral of pajamas, lo sach lo begon almana, of this woman who lives alone? Is it, a guy's going to come to the apartment of this almana, and she's going to stand behind the door with a pair of pajamas, and he's going to stand as, he says, that's not proper. So the Rabbanan say, so he says, therefore, he's Doresh Taima Dekra. He says that the meaning of the pasuk, therefore, is the reason is not to put this unseemly situation. What if she's a wealthy person? She says, no problem. I have 10 dresses in my closet. No problem. Take a dress and hold on to it. What's the big deal? I have 20 sweaters. Take 5 sweaters and hold on to it. So Reb Shimon says, it's not a problem. Because there's no interaction between these people. It doesn't apply. And the Rabbanan say, wrong, not true. Just because you think that the reason of the pasuk not to take the pajamas of this widow is because of that, it doesn't matter. Therefore, it applies across the board. And you cannot take, even if she has 100 sweaters, even if she has 50 pairs of shoes, you can't take the clothing of this widow as collateral. Okay? So that's how we paskin. We paskin, you do not use the rationale for the mitzvah to regulate the performance of the mitzvah. But we still think that the rationale for the mitzvah is very important. How do I know that? Because the Rambam wrote the Mor Nevuchim, and he tried to understand, at least as much as a human mind can, what is the mitzvah trying to say to me? The Sefer HaChinuch, the great Spanish work of the 613 mitzvahs, which is anonymously written, it may have been Rav Aaron Halevi of Spain, may have been his brother. He spent a lot of time in every mitzvah trying to figure out what is the meaning of the mitzvah. Why is he doing that? Because the mitzvah is supposed to be also relevant. It's supposed to teach you something. So the story of Shemitah, that's supposed, the Tama mitzvah, is also going to teach us something. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So therefore, Chazal said, according to the Rabbanan, we paskin, there's no, you don't get into the discussion of relativity. And therefore, they say, you cannot take her clothing at all. Because you can't use what you think is the reason for the mitzvah to regulate the mitzvah. So what I'm pointing out is that, because someone will come in here and say, what do you mean? Lower darshina taima dekra. You can't look at the reason for the mitzvah. So what that you think that's the reason for the mitzvah? Maybe there's another reason. You can't regulate the performance of based on the mitzvah. And that's true. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't look for the meaning of the mitzvah. It doesn't mean you shouldn't try to make it relevant to you. That's why it's such a good term, tam ha-mitzvah. The word tam means reason, but what else does it mean? Right? That's what it means, the flavor, a taste. Because I eat because, I probably eat too much, but I eat because I have to eat 3 square meals a day. That's a healthy way to live. The Rambam says you have to eat healthy, so you eat 3 square meals a day. But you don't want to eat just totally bland food. You get into it. So some people, they like, we find there are people who like spicy food. That really, I couldn't handle spicy food. You have some people, they like certain cuisine they grew up with from their parents, and some people like, it means it's relevant to you. Is there any difference between, let's say you like spicy food. Is the spicy food necessarily more healthful? Not necessarily. It depends on the ingredients. It's just that's what speaks to you. That's what it's going to move you to want to eat lunch, because you're going to be excited. Oh, you're doing takeout from this and this place, or somebody made you such and such a sandwich. That's, So that's the same thing for mitzvah. So what is the reason for the mitzvah of Shemitah? So there are several different options. The Sefer HaChinuch says, he says it's like Shabbos. It reminds you that everything belongs to God. Because on Shemitah, you're not allowed to work the land. Not only are you not allowed to work the land, you also have to leave it open to the public. You're not allowed to hoard it. That's one element. There is a Kliyaka, Rav Ephraim of Lunchitz. He says, you know what it's about? It's about Emunah. Emunah, the faithfulness that Hashem says, you leave it alone. You say, look, okay, I don't know how it's going to work out, but we're going to leave it alone. But then the Rama says in the Mor Nevuchim, the Rambam says, and this is where it comes closer to us, the Rambam says the following. Here it is. The Rambam says, Yesh mehen le'inyan chemla u'laharchiv al kol b'nei adam. They have, certain mitzvahs have a measure of compassion, and they are about all the people. What is that? The Pasuk says, Va'achlu evyone amecha. What happens on Shemitah? Let's say we had a field. So the din is, let's say we have an orchard. So there, I'm not allowed to plant. Let's say we had a cornfield. I can't plant the cornfield. So there's not going to be much to eat. But if I have an orchard, so I have a beautiful orchard, it's going to grow whether I plant it or not. I can't prune it. It's not going to be as perfect as it was in other years. But I'm not allowed to lock the gate on the orchard. Everybody comes to eat. Va'ochlu evyone amecha. And the word evyon is different than ani. Rashi points out in one place, Evyon means the absolute indigent, completely, completely impoverished. The most poor, the most desperate. So the Rambam says, V'achlu Evyon Yamecha, why is this? Lachmol al ha'avodim v'ho'aniyim. Everybody can eat. The Rambam also adds that it's good for the land. So agriculturally, that's a question. Leaving it fallow for a year, is that necessarily good for the land? Today they say, I saw some people say it's better to actually plant something else rather than the same thing. I don't know how it works in Illinois, but when we drove to St. Louis, there's a lot of farmland in Illinois. So you have to ask the local farmers right here in Illinois. But the Rambam, according to the Rambam, he thinks that one of the things is that if you don't work the land every year consecutively forever and ever, it's going to be good for the land. But the bottom line is from this Rambam, is that it's also about taking care of the people. Because what happens is nobody can balabatish, nobody can say, everything is mine. You can have somebody who becomes a very wealthy landowner and they have tons and tons of vineyards, but they're not allowed to hoard it in their house. And let's say you do bring it into your house, at a certain point, what do you have to do? You have to take it outside and leave it as hefker for everybody. And that brings us to one other aspect of Shemitah, which is called Shemitas Ksafim. You notice that when we say, it's interesting, it's not surprising to me, when we say Yizkor, we mentioned this, I think, last time, we say Yizkor, generally, except for Yom Kippur, we say Yizkor when we read Aser to Aser, which is about the mitzvah of giving tzedakah. And that's why we read Yizkor, because you give tzedakah in memory of the people who have gone. But in that context, there is a discussion of Shemitah. Most people don't pay attention to it, but it's not the regular discussion about Shemitah. It's a discussion about Shemitas Ksafim, about the invalidation of loans. And that is that if a person has a loan which is due, and we paskin it's at the end of the year, so at the end of this coming year, right before Rosh Hashanah, if somebody owed you money, unless you went to make some special arrangement with the Beis Din called a Prusbol, so then that loan is canceled. So there was one article that I saw by Rav Yisrael Rosen, who claims that actually Shemitah it's not a universal social type of thing. It doesn't really help the poor people because it ends up that there's no business and therefore the poor people are harmed. So I think he's probably right to some degree, but I think Be'etzim, I think he's wrong. I think he's not correct. And I saw an article from Rav Yuval Sherlo who totally disagrees with him. And in this Kibbutz Hadati collection, they also have this discussion. I went online and I found out that I guess everyone's familiar with the payday loan industry. You see them in street corners in different places, right? The payday loans. So who goes for a payday loan? Right, people who are poor, who are desperate. So do you know how much money the payday loan industry generates? Billions of dollars. I couldn't believe it. I went online and I found that in 2012, profit margins was between $6 and $8 billion. Not the amount that's being transacted, the amount that the payday lenders are bringing in. You're talking about dozens of billions of dollars that's being transacted in payday loans. So I say to myself, wait a second, whose loans are these? These are the loans of poor people who are living paycheck to paycheck. They need money. They need a little bit of money here, a little bit of money there. These are the Evyone Amecha. You're right. The Prusbul, the action that continues the loans, of course it benefits big business, because his argument is, who are the major people who are lending money? The wealthy people. They buy this property on credit, then they buy the next property on credit. That's all true. But you're right. But who also gets hurt are the payday loan guys, the little guys who just borrow a little bit of money. And it's huge. Don't tell me it's not a big industry. It's a huge industry. So those people who have this small amount of money that they're looking for, that's their michya. That's all they're going to live on. And you're talking about billions and billions of dollars. So the fact that there's a concept of Shemitah's Ksafim, it definitely is for the little guy. There's no question. You can't deny it. So all of a sudden, now you have a situation where, from a Torah society standpoint, you're setting up a system where all the fields are supposed to be left alone, meaning the wealthy landowners, they're not going to be able to make the same profit that they would every other year. It's not a perfect equalizer. There's no such thing. And it only applies to the ground. It doesn't apply to business people. It doesn't apply to salaried workers. It doesn't apply to service providers. It doesn't apply to medical professionals. It's only the ground. But keep in mind, way back when, the vast majority of people were earning money from the land. It was an agrarian society. So you're right. It's going to affect some people less. But bigadol, the people who are massive landowners, they're not going to be able to bring in the same kind of money that they would have. And the little people who are, in those days, the story of Ruth, what's she doing? She's going from one field to the next to collect a few bundles. So now, all of a sudden, it used to be that you would have to wait. You would have to wait until the owner would leave Peah, or would harvest, take leket and shichicha, they would leave it out in the field. Then you can go, if you were a poor person, lo aleinu, then you could go get it. But Shemitah, that's not the case. You just can walk around anytime during the season. So during, you know, it depends. If you have winter wheats, it'll be in the wintertime. If you have grapes, it'll be in the summertime. All of a sudden, it's open for everybody. And the concept of Shemitah's Ksafim does relate in a certain sense to the business sector. Now, you're right. Hillel famously was misaking a Prusbul, this special device that will keep the loan going. But that was only because the opposite effect happened, which was that people stopped lending money. And the whole basis of commerce is that you should be able to transact based on loans. But the idea that the society needs to take into consideration the economic inequality that exists is something that's certainly, I think, seems to me, that's certainly part of the Tam HaMitzvah of Shemitah, according to this Rambam. And that's what gets interesting, that now, in this article, and you can look in the news, there became a whole thing called Shemitah Yisraelit. Shemitah Yisraelit. Who is it? A group of non-religious Jews. Non-religious Jews in Israel decided that this year they wanted, what do they want to put on the agenda? Economic inequality. So in one of these articles, one of the members of one of these kibbutzim talks about this, he connects the dots. Shemitah Yisraelit, that even though, you know, one Shemitah Yisraelit, it's not a halachic institution, but the Tam HaMitzvah, and he harkens back in one of these essays to the economic inequality protests of the summer of 2011. That as a society, we need to address the needs of these people. Now, it doesn't mean that in the Torah viewpoint, you have to have a socialist society. It doesn't mean it has to be capitalist. It means you have to take care of people's needs. Nowhere in the Chumash does it say that anybody has rights. Now, you're looking at me funny. You're thinking, there's no Bill of Rights in the Torah. None. Nowhere. It doesn't say it anywhere. It doesn't say I have rights. It means it says I have responsibilities. I have responsibilities to take care of the people who are underprivileged, to take care of of the poor, to take care of the people who are the ger, the yosom, the almana, all those different people. So there becomes a question, how best to build a Torah society to fulfill all those responsibilities. But the idea that, you know, you have to think about what it's going to cost the poor person, how much, so That is got to be it. Now, again, I don't know how to do that. You have to ask the experts in economics. You have to ask the experts in the social psychology. But that's part of the, in the table of contents here, they have a whole discussion about different aspects of Shemitah. But one of them is Shemitah Yisraelit, this secular phenomenon. So one discussion here is about maybe we should have a rest from technology. Maybe we should take a break from technology for a little bit. One of them is we should figure out how other sectors of society, and particularly one of the essays here is about high-tech. Because in Israel, the high-tech industry is very big. So what does Shemitah mean for the high-tech industry? Such an interesting question. Again, it's not actual practical Shemitah, but it's the time of Dekra of Shemitah. So it all comes back, I think, to one and one final note. Very good. So it comes back to one piece. So I have here, I downloaded the whole Sefer, because you could do that today. So Rav Kook has a Sefer on the laws of Shemitah called Shabbos Haaretz. It's a little Sefer. I don't know where it is here. Anyway, so Rav Kook has a Sefer called Shabbos Haaretz, and in the introduction to Shabbos Haaretz, he talks about the spirit of the law of Shemitah. And there, make it bigger so I can read it. So there, he compares Shemitah to Shabbos. You notice how it says Vishavsa in the parasha of Shemitah. It says it seven times. It's the seventh year. Rav Kook was very involved in the story of Shemitah because he was living in Yafo and he was dealing especially with the Heter Mechira, which is not today's discussion. So he says, Shnas Shavason Muchrachasi Lo'uma V'la'aretz. A year of sabbatical is necessary for the nation. Shnas Sheket V'shalva. A year of quiet and tranquility. Be'ein Nogeis V'rode. A person who has creditors hounding him, he never has Menuchas HaNefesh because he's always worrying about the guy, the collector, the guy who's behind him. It says in this year, because the pasuk says Lo yigos esre'eu ve'es achiv ki karash mita lashem. Nobody's knocking at your door. Sometimes you hear on the news, lo aleinu, people who have terrible bills that are piling up. They're afraid to open their mailbox. Says Rav Kook, you don't have to worry about that on Shemitah because nobody's coming to collect their debts. Shnas shivyon umargoa. It is a year of equality and taking it easy. Hispashtus haneshama. Baharchavasa el hayashar ha'eloki ha'mechalkel chayim b'chesed. Says Rav Kook, it's a very noble concept, and that is that we're supposed to be letting go of the physical possessions that we have. Ein rechush prati mesuyam. It's not my field. I can't say this is my field. Why? Because I can't exert any ownership over it. Maybe technically, from a deed standpoint, it's my field, but what does that mean? It means nothing. I can't sell it. I can't do business with it. I can't lock the gate in front of somebody else. So in practicality, I have no ownership of it. He says, what's that? You cannot do business with perishvius. Correct. If you, let's say I bring in, you're allowed to bring in food for your family. So let's say I have an apple orchard. So I bring in, you know, a dozen apples and I have five left over. So I'm allowed to sell five apples on the street. But I can't say, oh, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to bring in 500 apples and I'm going to sell them, make a business out of it.
No, I can't. I thought you were saying you can't sell the field.
No, you cannot sell the fruit. You can't sell the fruit.
Okay.
You can't sell the fruit.
Okay. All right.
He says, "Velo zechus kavdanis." You can't sell. Tell people, don't come in my field because it's for every reason. Vishorer eloki shorer alkol asher neshama ve'apo. Says Rav Kook, you're supposed to get away from your hold on materialism and focus on your neshama. In a certain sense, it's like taking what Rav Kook does is create this beautiful harmony of all the different reasons for Shemitah that we started with. One reason was from the Sefer HaChinuch to say, you're not the balabas on the world. The Rabbono Shalom is balabas. So it's not my private property. And I have emunah. And I'm taking care of all of society. All those things together. He says, Rav Kook, what is it? It's a time to focus on the spiritual component of our lives. The same way that on Shabbos, on an individual level, I'm supposed to say, wait a second. I'm not the one that's creating everything in the world. The Rabbono Shalom is doing that. So too, when it comes to Shemitah, on a national level, everybody's supposed to say, what are our moral and ethical obligations to God? That's what our national agenda should be. That's what we should be having, you know, conventions about on Shemitah. Nobody should be going to work. Everybody should be going to the convention to figure out, as a nation, how can we best be spiritual and not get so hung up on the physical things. And the two go together. Because if you're so worried, if you're always only focused on your material possessions, so then you can't have any headspace to worry about the spirit. If you have some time to worry about the world of the spirit, then it actually puts everything into perspective. Because the bottom line is, the field, you can't take that with you after 120. You can't take any of the material possessions. What do you take? You take the spiritual accomplishments that we have in this world. And that's what Shemitah is about. It's about recalibrating our values. Just like on Shabbos is on a micro level, so Shemitah is on a massive macro level. And that's what they're talking about in this kenis. And it's amazing. In our whole lifetime, this is the discussion. This is the discourse. We're missing out of it because we're losers living in Chutz Laaretz. But in Israel, this is really the conversation that's happening now. How to create a society, which is not perfect and it's challenging and it's predominantly not traditional Torah perspectives. But as Rav Kook would say, you see, even in the secular Jews, they're talking about Shemitah Yisraelit, because that's the heart of Shemitah. The heart of Shemitah, according to Rav Kook, is trying to be more noble, trying to be more compassionate, trying to be more spiritual and less mundane and less hung up on all the little things. So even though I would say that the whole notion of an Olim LeBerlin movement is antithetical to Torah on many, many levels, the idea that we need to be constantly focusing, and especially during a Shemitah year, that we need to be focusing on what are the economic needs of society as a whole, and how do we as a Torah society, ideally, of course, in Eretz Yisrael, how do we take care of the needs of those people? What are the institutions that we need to put into place? What are the mechanisms that we can use in appropriate ways under the proper, with the proper, I don't want to use the word regulation too much, but with the proper regulation and boundaries and supervision and oversight, that we can take care of everybody's needs, and that once every 7 years, we recalibrate ourselves. And that's a great opportunity that we have in Shemitah, and you can take a look online if you'd like. I'll be happy to forward you some of these articles. I don't have too much in English. Everything here is in very, very modern Hebrew, but it's not, you know, take a little piece out of it. So if you want, I'm happy to forward it. And Yasher Koach, have a great day. Mir Tashem, packets will be back next week, because this is no good. This is no good.
Thank you.
All right. No, don't worry. It's all good. Okay. That's right.
We'll focus on you.
Except on Shmini Atzeret, unless it's Shabbos.
Most of the time
we start from Kola before.
Right.
But the point is still a good point.
It's interesting that the whole concept that you're talking about, young people can never get a loan and then there's that whole issue about land owning property in Israel. You know, we talk about all the time now. Released at the pier, and they should hold 1 or 2 days if they hold property. And it actually talks to that whole thing that you're not still in Israel, but living in Israel involves owning property, and you're not even allowing that us to do that. Well, if that's the case, then, well, we might as well go to Berlin, because you know what? We don't even own property. So it kind of like disengages all these young people to even the obligation of Berlin, because you're not even letting us, if we would even want to live there, if we would want to even have a mix of so it's really an interesting concept. So, you know, why don't you choose Amsterdam or something? I'm sure that the price of pudding would be the same in Amsterdam.
Ukraine. I'm sure it's very cheap in Ukraine.
Absolutely. Yes. But it was definitely a poignant article.
Thank you. Have a great week.
Maybe I'm not remembering correctly, but I thought realized
Rabbi Yosef makes that connection.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Rabbi Yosef has the connection. He raises it about a cover story.
Right.
In those days, it was
So
he raises that question. That's how I found this story.
Similar.
Yes.
And the other thing is, you know, sometimes
I think this is going to be for Wednesday night, so...
That's right, I'm going to be out for Wednesday night, so okay. I heard it, and I won't give away the ending.
So, Nathan,
how are you?
Great,
I'm out of here.
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
Did you stop it?
No.
All right, 100%.